Quelques mots, bien sûr. Donc, avant de lui laisser la parole, Robin, may I ask you to come over? Thank you. Sur le professeur Robin Le Poitevin, que je suis vraiment heureuse et honorée d'accueillir aujourd'hui parmi nous au Collège de France. Robin Le Poitevin est professeur de métaphysique à l'Université de Leeds, où il enseigne depuis 1989. 1989, that's right, yes. That's correct. Il a occupé la Gifford Fellowship à l'Université de St. Andrews, la Stanton Lectureship à Cambridge et la Richardson Fellowship à l'Université de Durham. Outre l'intérêt jamais démenti qu'il manifeste pour la philosophie de la religion, il est certainement l'un des philosophes qui ont apporté une contribution marquante à la réflexion contemporaine sur le temps. Donc, parmi ces très nombreuses publications, je me contenterai d'évoquer quelques-uns de ses livres. Donc, d'abord son ouvrage de 1991, Change, Cause and Contradiction, A Defense of the Tenseless Theory of Time, Londres Macmillan, Arguing for Atheism, Introduction to the Philosophy of Religion, London Routledge, 1996, son livre de 2003, paru chez Oxford University Press, Travels in Four Dimensions, ou encore The Images of Time, Oxford University Press 2007. Agnosticism, A Very Short Introduction, toujours Oxford University Press 2010, et plus récemment, si je ne m'abuse, en 2019, Religious Fictionalism, Cambridge University Press. Donc je suis très impatiente, comme vous tous, je le sais, de l'entendre nous parler de la mémoire de MacTaggart et de la métaphysique descriptive du temps. Je précise donc que le professeur Poitevin donnera son exposé en anglais, mais il va de soi que vos questions à la suite de son intervention pourront indifféremment être posées dans la langue de Shakespeare ou dans celle de Malherbe. Welcome, dear Robin. So many thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Claudine, and thank you for the invitation to be here. I'm very pleased to be here. I hope I will be forgiven for delivering this talk in English. That simply reflects my own linguistic limitations. I'm not attempting to make a political point. I wouldn't want to confirm any impressions you may have formed over the last year or two about the insularity of the United Kingdom. So I want to begin by rehearsing a distinction that Peter Strawson makes in his 1959 book, Individuals, between descriptive and what he calls revisionary metaphysics. Here is how he puts it. Descriptive metaphysics is content to describe the actual structure of our thought about the world. Revisionary metaphysics is concerned to produce a better structure. The implication is, of course, that revisionary metaphysics, as the name would suggest, overturns our ordinary ways of thinking about the world. But many contemporary metaphysicians are concerned rather to vindicate the way we ordinarily think about such things as time, causality, ordinary objects, persons, and so on. So it might perhaps be better to talk of a distinction between descriptive metaphysics, describing how we actually think, and prescriptive metaphysics, which is concerned with how we ought to think about the world. However, since descriptive and prescriptive sound rather similar words, I will continue to use Strawson's own term, revisionary metaphysics, with the proviso that some revisionary metaphysics isn't so revisionary. Yeah. Now, he goes on to make this the following rather puzzling remark, but revisionary metaphysics is at the service of descriptive metaphysics. He doesn't immediately explain what he means by that, and never does so explicitly, but we might perhaps get a hint of what he means by looking at two of the figures that he puts on either side of the descriptive revisionary divide. Strawson says, of course, that virtually no philosopher is wholly either descriptive or wholly a revisionary metaphysician, but on the whole, we can describe Kant as predominantly a descriptive metaphysician, concerned to explore our own ordinary conceptual scheme, whereas Berkeley is a revisionary metaphysician. I'm not sure how much these two would have agreed entirely with that classification. Kant is indeed concerned to describe our ordinary conceptual scheme. He thinks that we should be concerned as philosophers with the world of appearances. We can say very little about the world as it is in itself. Nevertheless, you might remember what he does in the Antinomies of Pure Reason, where he sets about showing that the world in itself, as it is in itself, can contain neither time nor space. That sounds a pretty revisionary thesis. Time and space are forms of intuition. They are in structures that we impose on our experience in order to be able to understand it. So here, revisionary metaphysics, negative revisionary metaphysics, is used to limit the task of theoretical philosophy to the world of appearances. Berkeley, who is, of course, an idealist, which you might think is a pretty revisionary view, nevertheless says, in a famous phrase, "I side in all things with the mob." He is not so much concerned, as he sees it, to overturn our ordinary conception of things as to draw out their implications. Well, I want to apply this descriptive revisionary distinction to time and theories of time. So let's move on to what I've referred to as the old and the new B theories. I'm putting these in inverted commas for reasons that will become apparent. So the old B theory of time, which is associated with Bertrand Russell, holds that the meaning of tensed language, so this is language which uses such terms as now, then, yesterday, tomorrow, in a few years' time, language, in other words, that intimates the speaker's own relation, own temporal relation to the events of which he or she is speaking, that the meaning of this kind of language is analyzable in terms of tenseless language, language that does not intimate the speaker's own position in time vis-a-vis the events they are speaking of. So an example of tenseless expression would be 9:25 on the 3rd of October 2019. Now, in contrast, the new B theory, and I put new in inverted commas there because it is the theory that emerged in the 1980s, and some of us probably think of the 1980s as some way in the past. This new B theory was associated with J.J. G. Smart and Hugh Miller in particular, who do not want to suggest that the meaning of tense language can be conveyed in tenseless terms. Tense languages and thought is in some sense irreducible, but it nevertheless has tenseless truth conditions. Let me explain what is meant by that. So, according to the new B theory, a given utterance of "it is now windy in Paris," thankfully false, uttered at a particular token at a particular time, is true if and only if, according to one account, that utterance is simultaneous with wind in Paris. So there's no suggestion here that the truth conditions involve the property of presentness, which windiness in Paris has. An alternative schema, that utterance is true if and only if it is windy in Paris at tea, where tea is specifiable in tenseless terms in the way that I did a moment ago at 9:25 on the 3rd of October 2019. Now, you might think that truth conditions are relevant to meaning. If you're explaining the meaning of a sentence, do you not have to give its truth conditions? So I think what the new B theory is saying is really this. Although we can understand the sentence, it is now windy in Paris, in terms of its truth conditions, its tenseless truth conditions, that's considering it as a type, when we consider an individual utterance, it's now windy in Paris, or an individual thought, the meaning of that can't be conveyed in these terms. I can say, it's now windy in Paris, without intending to say anything about my very utterance, its simultaneity with windiness in Paris, for example. And I can say it's windy now in Paris without knowing precisely what time at which I'm speaking. Anyway, that is a detail. Just applying Strawson's descriptive revisionary dichotomy to the new B theory, we can say this, that the new B theory concedes to its rival, the A theory, that according to our ordinary conceptual scheme, how we ordinarily think about things, time passes in reality. That's how we ordinarily think, the new B theorist is prepared to concede. And moreover, this distinction that we make between past, present, and future isn't purely perspectival. It's non-perspectival. It's something which obtains independently of my particular position in time. So this, the new B theory concedes, is how we ordinarily think. We ordinarily think that time passes. We ordinarily think that the past, present, and future distinction is not a merely perspectival thing. It's not like here and there. But as a matter of fact, our ordinary way of thinking is mistaken. Time, according to the B theory, does not pass. And the past, present, and future distinction is purely perspectival. It's precisely analogous to the distinction between here and there. Now, you can see that the new B theory, as it emerged in the 1980s, is clearly a piece of revisionary metaphysics. It's concerned to replace the way we ordinarily think with a different picture of reality altogether, a radically different picture altogether. Now, recently, in the philosophical literature, there's a sense that this B theory of the 1980s is perhaps a little bit too concessive to its rival. So the new B theorists, Meller, for example, were happy to concede that time seems to pass, that our ordinary experience seems to intimate an objective passage of time. And in recent years, some B theorists have been inclined to question that. There's been some skepticism expressed about the idea that ordinary temporal experience really does intimate or even seem to intimate an objective passage of time as conceived of by the A theory. Certainly things seem to change, but this does not amount to a sense, an experience of objective, the objective passage of time. So not only is there no veridical experience of the passage of time, because time doesn't pass, if you're a B theorist, there isn't even any experience as of the objective passage of time. And if that is the case, if the A theorist has been reading a little bit too much into our ordinary experience, perhaps it isn't actually part of our ordinary conceptual scheme, after all, that time really passes in the way that the A-theorist conceives of it. So what we have is the emergence of what we might call a new B-theory, an even newer B-theory, one that is less prepared than the older new B-theory to concede that our ordinary way of thinking about the world is as the A-theorist says that it is, that we think of time as passing, that we think of the past, present, and future distinction as non-perspectival. It's that latter point, the perspectival or non-perspectival nature of the past, present, and future distinction that I want to talk about particularly today. Now, going back to the new B theory as it was in the 1980s, and which was very influential for a very long time, we can ask this question: is it unstable? Okay, remember that the new B theory posits a radical difference between the way we ordinarily think about time. We ordinarily think it passes. We ordinarily think that the past, present, future distinction is non-perspectival. And, on the other hand, the way reality really is. We are fundamentally mistaken in our ordinary ways of thinking about time, according to the new B theory. Is that an unstable position? I think it depends on what you think the main motivation for the B theory is. If you deny that time passes, is that because you are impressed by relativistic physics? You feel that the findings of relativity are incompatible with an objective passage of time? Or are you perhaps worried about the intelligibility of the passage of time having a certain rate? If time passes, surely it does so at a certain rate, at a certain speed. But what is that rate? How do we describe it? Or perhaps you think that a proper understanding of tensed language, language of now, then, and so on, will show you that there's no such thing as the passage of time. Or are you impressed, as many B theorists are, with MacTaggart's paradox? Now, I will not undertake in this talk to explain in all its gory detail MacTaggart's paradox's proof of the unreality of time. It's quite a fearsome thing, but I will just summarize the basic points in a nutshell. I will not put it in precisely the same language as MacTaggart, but I think it boils down to this. An event, such as this talk, can't, on pain of contradiction, be both present in a non-perspectival sense, absolutely present, and also absolutely non-perspectively past. It could be here and there, but of course here and there are clearly purely perspectival things. Here with respect to one location, there with respect to another. But no event can be absolutely present and absolutely past. And yet any past event is also in some sense present. All past events were at some time stage present. Now we can attempt to avoid the contradiction in describing an event both as present and past by relativizing those descriptions to times. We say, well, yes, this talk is present on the 3rd of October, and it's past on the 4th of October. But there we make past and present purely perspectival. They become precisely analogous to here and there. It's present with respect to that time, past with respect to another, but not absolutely present or absolutely past. So if you think that events are absolutely present, but also in some sense absolutely past, you end up in contradiction. And that is a 2-minute summary of MacTaggart. Now, it is not my business here to persuade you of the cogency of this argument. Those of you, and that will be true of most people here, I think, who are familiar with MacTaggart, will already have formed a view as to whether the argument works or not. I will not preach to the converted, nor will I attempt to convert the unconverted. People tend to decide fairly early on whether they agree with MacTaggart, and I doubt if anything I could say would persuade you out of your opinion. The point I want to make is this, that if MacTaggart is right, there's a fundamental incoherence in the idea of events being absolutely present or absolutely past, and therefore an incoherence in the very idea of the objective passage of time. An incoherence, not just that it conflicts with what physics is talking about, what physics tells us, but an actual incoherence. Now remember, the new B theory, the 1980s B theory, conceded that our ordinary ways of thinking about time had it that time passed as a matter of objective fact, that the past, present, and future distinction is perspectival. The very things that MacTaggart thinks involve incoherence. So if there is an incoherence in the objective passage of time, in the non-perspectival nature of past, present, and future, then it seems that incoherence appears in our ordinary ways of thinking about the world. Ordinary ways of thinking about the world are simply incoherent. Now, I think that's a very uncomfortable position to take. We might be mistaken in our ordinary ways of thinking, but to suggest that our ordinary ways of thinking are actually incoherent looks a rather bold thesis. And we might not be willing to accept it. Nothing wrong with my ordinary ways of thinking about the world. I mean, they might be mistaken, but they are not confused, we might say. Who are these philosophers to tell us that we are simply confused? Now, perhaps there is a way out of the problem. It's become almost orthodoxy that one way for the atheist, someone who believes in the objective passage of time, to avoid MacTaggart's contradiction is to be a presentist, to think that only what presently exists is real. So we can say that this talk is absolutely present. That is what reality is. Reality does not contain the fact that this same talk is objectively past. Only what is present is real. So perhaps you can believe in the objective passage of time and not end up in contradiction if you are a presentist. If that's the case, and if our ordinary conceptual scheme, the way we ordinarily think about the world, is presentist, if we are inclined to think that only what is present is real, even when we're not doing philosophy, then there is no contradiction in our ordinary ways of thinking. The problem is it's not at all clear that presentism is part of our ordinary ways of thinking. Here again, maybe a case where philosophers are simply importing their theories into an understanding of how we ordinarily think and talk. Do we think the past is unreal? Ordinarily, before we start doing any philosophy. Not obvious that we do. For one thing, we are, I think it is plausible to say, inclined to think there's a crucial difference between the past and the future. That is, we are inclined, it could be said, to think that although there is a fact about what happened in this auditorium yesterday, there's no fact of the matter as to what will happen tomorrow. we have a pretty good idea of what is going to be happening in this auditorium tomorrow, but there's as yet no fact of the matter. Events might intervene. I certainly hope they won't, but they might. We also have memories of the past. The past is not real. What is the basis of those memories? Whereas we do not have any precognitive intimations of the future. No reliable ones, at any rate, not like our memories, but our reliable, relatively reliable intimations of the past. I have to be careful what I say here. A few years ago, I was giving a talk where I asserted that we have no precognitive intimations of the future, and a member of the audience said, I have precognitive intimations of the future. Would you like to hear what they are? But fortunately, the chair intervened at that point, so I never got to hear what this this person's vision of the future was going to be like. But I think most of us can agree, can we not, that although we have memories, access to the past, we don't have access to the future in quite the same way. So there's something about our memory that suggest to us there's something, there's a reality to the past that the future lacks. Now, there's a particular kind of memory that I think is particularly significant when we are considering the question whether past, present, and future are purely perspectival or not, and that is episodic memory. Now, episodic memory is not just remembering that such and such an event occurred, but you remember what it was like to experience that event. You remember the event from the inside, to use an expression that's been applied to episodic memory. You remember perhaps your first day at school, for example. You don't simply remember what happened, but you remember what it felt like to be in that situation. You can conjure up the memory. Now, episodic memory, this vivid access we have to our own experiential past, is, of course, an essential part of the human condition. And it is something that writers and poets have made much use of, including these four that you see up on the screen, the most famous description of episodic memory, of course, is in Marcel Proust's Remembrance of Times Past, but I cannot possibly quote Proust to a French audience. That would be real cheek. So I'll use some other examples as well. Thomas Hardy, for example, talks episodic memory in these terms. Time to make me grieve steals part, lets part abide, and shakes this fragile frame at eve with throbbings of noontide. He knew a lot about the agonies of episodic memory. T.S. Eliot, in Four Quartets, exploring the nature of our experience of time. Time present and time past are both perhaps contained in time future. I'm not entirely sure what he means by that. But perhaps one of the most famous, certainly the most poignant for me, descriptions of episodic memory by Philip Larkin, who writes in reference back, truly, though our element is time, we are not suited to the long perspectives open at each instant of our lives. They link us to our losses. Worse, they show us what we had as it once was, just as though by acting differently, we could have kept it so. It's interesting that Larkin talks about perspectives here and memory showing us what we had as it once was. It seems to be part of the characteristic structure of episodic memory that an event, an experience we're remembering, is presented as present and past. We recognize that this is a past event in our lives, this is a past experience we have had. This is past, but it's also presented to us, represented to us, as present. Now, I'm not suggesting that we are somehow deluded when we call up a vivid image of an experience in our own pasts, we are not deluded into thinking that it truly is present, but we experience it again almost as if it were. It's not a matter of belief here. We don't believe that it is both present and past, but we are presented with it as present as well as past. And that suggests that there is some sort of tension here. How can an event be both present and past? Don't our episodic memories present us, as it were, with a conflict, a contradiction that has to be resolved? Now, we could resolve it by simply rejecting one of those representations, by seeing the episodic memory as, in some sense, illusory. It's presenting something to us as present. But we don't reject episodic memory as illusory. We don't think of it as a hallucination. We think of it as giving us knowledge of our own, or potentially knowledge of our own experiential pasts. And what I want to suggest is that we avoid this tension between a representation on the one hand of this event in our pasts as present, and also its presentation as past, by recognizing that they are purely perspectival. Episodic memory gives us another perspective on our experience. We have a present perspective on that experience, it is in the past. But we can also imaginatively project ourselves into our own pasts and see that event once more as present, while all the time recognizing that this is purely perspectival. So here's an analogy. Supposing, as might well be the case, I am completely lost somewhere in Paris, but I am talking to you via mobile phone, and I say to you, I am completely lost. Where do I go? And of course, you want to know where I am. So you say to me, well, what can you see at the moment? And I start to describe my surroundings. Maybe I'd say, well, I can see Notre Dame in front of me. What you could then do, what you may well do, is imaginatively project yourself into my own spatial location. That's not an illusion. You don't think you are located where I am, but you imagine yourself located where I am. You see things from my perspective. We often do this. We try and see things from each other's perspective, recognizing that others' perspectives are as valid as our own. And what I want to suggest is that this is what's happening in episodic memory. It is presenting us with different temporal perspectives on our lives, past perspectives, and we can recognize those perspectives as just as valid as our current perspective. So coming back to the new B theory, as it emerged in the 1980s, according to which, as we ordinarily think of things, time passes objectively, and also this distinction between past and present is purely, it's a non-perspectival, it's an absolute matter. Maybe that's conceding too much to the A theory. Perhaps our ordinary ways of thinking, informed as they about time, informed as they are in part by our memories, particularly our episodic memories, may present past, present, and future as perspectival, rather like here and there. And we should be very cautious as revisionary metaphysicians before ascribing incoherence to our ordinary ways of thinking about the world. And that is a moral we might apply to other debates in metaphysics as well. So philosophy is full of examples of cases where people have wanted to replace our ordinary conceptual schemes, our ordinary ways of thinking about the world, with a radically different picture. Think of the clash between materialism versus idealism. Perhaps we are naturally materialists and have to be persuaded to be idealists by subtle philosophers. Or perhaps we believe in that objects are composite, that they have parts, and we have to be persuaded out of that by cunning arguments to the effect that really all that exists are things that don't have parts, the mereological nihilist view. Or perhaps we believe that we persist through time by being wholly present at every time at which we exist, and we have to be persuaded out of that and think of ourselves as simply locked into each time, and we are succeeded by, as it were, lookalikes. Or we might believe that causation is something that links individual events rather than just regularities in the world. So metaphysics is full of examples where our ordinary ways of thinking have been challenged. Is that kind of revisionary metaphysics unstable? Well, I think it depends entirely on the motivation for that metaphysics. And if the suggestion is that we should abandon these ways of thinking because they are incoherent, that suggests that we are in a state of confusion in our ordinary thinking. And that is a view that I think a philosopher should think twice before suggesting. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.